Welcome to the GBC Big Three podcast, a weekly podcast where we sit down and unpack three big questions raised from our Sunday sermon. I'm your host, Matt Willis, and my co-host again this week for second week in a row. It's none other than the delightful Roxanne Lawler. How you going, my friend?
Oh, pretty good. How are you going, Mr. Willis?
Good. We are almost running this joint.
We are. Oh my God.
It is just the a couple of days to go. Margarita in the building.
Woohoo.
And then
it's all on us. It is. And then we'll just go visit and watch him play hockey.
Yes.
Apparently, ice hockey.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
Yes, we're
so
have
much
to do
fun.
That. Yeah.
But we'll also install slides instead of staircases.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe
a new logo. I don't know.
Oh, yeah, the whole thing. are we Guymie Baptist Church anymore?
Yeah,
or are we something else?
I don't know. The church on the highway.
Oh,
let's go with that. Hopefield Church. I don't know.
Gosh,
let's.
Power is going to our heads. Thankfully, there's a CLT who will keep us very much in line.
They certainly will.
God oh, well, that's great, my friend.
I'm excited.
I'm excited to have you on the Big Three again.
Stoked to be here.
Fantastic. Well, for those of you who missed it, our senior pastor, Mark Rader, preached during our Easter Sunday services, wrapping up our series for the season in 3 days. Mark spoke from the book of Ephesians about the new temple made for all and by all. And you can listen to that message again through our regular GBC Sermons podcast. And so today, in the Big Three, as always, we're going to keep the conversation going from Sunday's message. In a moment, we're going to be joined by Mark, and Rox and I will be putting the Big Three questions to him as we dive deeper into the invitation from this week's sermon. But for now, Rox, what was your kind of take home? What stood out for you in Rader's message on Sunday?
Oh, man. Well, I think for me, it was sort of the culmination of the whole Easter weekend, right? So we've been looking at this in 3 days, the temple, and how Jesus said he's going to rebuild the temple in three days. And, you know, we looked at that from the perspective of the cross and the resurrection, et cetera. But I think I really liked how Mark took it from being like a historical biblical perspective into actually what does that mean for us now?
What does it mean?
What does that 3 days do for us?
Mm.
And that whole concept of how Jesus' death and resurrection takes these two groups of people, the Jews and the Gentiles, and unites them into one new people group
the purple people,
which if you haven't heard the sermon you'll be like, what the heck with the purple,
who are they?
Exactly.
I don't understand.
So I really loved just the fact that it was about the here and now and what it was for us, that sense of unity that we make the temple and we make the church. Such a different perspective, because often we hear about forgiveness of sins, which is critical, very important.
It's a big deal.
However, we don't often hear that perspective.
Yeah.
So that was I enjoyed that.
Yes. And I think we should probably explain that like the purple people, which is going to come up in a few of our big three questions. It was that whole idea of the Jews were kind of red and the Gentiles were blue.
Yeah.
And rather than making a community of red with blue dots or blue with red stripes, they made something new.
Yeah.
And were kind of transformed through what Jesus did on the cross, which got a bit of a snicker from me and anyone who's been in youth ministry in the last while, because we used to have a rule at youth camp
where
boys were blue and girls were red and there was no purple.
No purple.
Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden our senior pastor gets up on the platform and he's like, guys, we need to be purple.
Yeah.
We need to be purple. Let's be purple people.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so we just have to sit our young people down
and explain the difference. Okay, but not you. And not like
You are in the temple.
You are, exactly. This is different.
Not on youth camp.
All youth are sitting there going,
what the heck?
I
know, it was a vibe. It was a vibe.
Yep.
Well, before we get on to the inner workings of young people.
There's a long service leave's going to go well, isn't it?
We've got this, Rox. We've got it. I think it's time for us to start looking at the three big questions submitted through Slido this week. So, Rox, what are our big three?
Oh, man, there's some crackers. The first one is, well, what barriers do we need to push through to establish that purple community, that unified body of believers? What are the barriers?
Because, like, particularly for the Jews, they had huge barriers. They had a whole history of sacrificial law and, laws
set apartness.
Yes, right?
Food
that they
laws.
Had to, that were kind of being deconstructed along with the temple. Boom, pun intended.
In 3 days.
In 3 days, there you go. Oh, we don't even need radar. We've got this. Go on long Sabbath sleep. All right, stop there. So, please, question two.
Question two. Well, Jesus died, so there is a new purple way of being with God. But is it a problem that there seems to be different types of purple?
Yeah.
You know, so like different types of churches, I imagine this question is about, maybe denominations. Mm. I think maybe that question
is there. Yeah. Is there still, like, is there still a right and a wrong?
Yeah.
Do you get what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, that's what I read in that.
Are the purples different shades? Like, are we talking lavender here and lilac? I don't know.
I'm really impressed that you knew purple colours because I was drawing a blank. Very good.
All right. Question number three is, if anyone can begin to follow Jesus, which is something that Mark had said in the sermon, what might it look like? You know, like, what does it look like to follow Jesus? And how is that different to faith? Or is that faith?
Is that faith? Yeah.
Is that faith? What's that like?
Absolutely.
Yeah. What does it look like?
Help us. Well, here to help us is Mark Rayner. Please don't leave. We joke about it, but please don't. We need someone to wrangle us in.
Yes, exactly, obviously.
The big three is going to be interesting.
Oh, my gosh.
She's going to be listening from home. Yeah. how did you find Easter, Mark? Was it everything you hoped to be? I don't know what I want from that question.
Well, I mean, personally, it was a little bit different. We'd planned to do like some family stuff, as I think lots of people did. And
then
in the end, one of my daughters ended up with COVID. So, like that just kind of threw a lot of that into disarray to some degree. And it was another of my daughter's birthday just before Easter. So the celebration was a little bit, not muted, but it was a little bit like,
Okay.
It didn't quite work out. But that was fine. So it was kind of a quieter weekend than we had originally planned, but that wasn't entirely bad. And I think, you know, I'd probably share your reflections, Rox, that I quite enjoyed preaching and thinking about the death and resurrection of Jesus from the perspective of the temple. Like, I think one of the real challenges that I experience, you know, particularly at Christmas and Easter, is like, there's limits to what you can preach, right? Yeah. Like,
it's got to be about Christmas and Easter.
It's a prescribed text.
But it's also, I think, really important that I know I've learned that it's important that I'm engaged in what I'm doing. And so I found that really quite energizing to be thinking about the death and resurrection of Jesus. Again, not to the exclusion, as you say, of forgiveness or of victory over death or many of the more prominent themes, but I found it really energizing to be thinking about the temple complex. And again, I think part of it for me was just, again, the realization that Jesus doesn't talk a lot in the lead up to his death and resurrection about forgiveness of sins or victory over death.
Yeah.
I mean, it's in there, but that's not what he got pegged for. You know, in his trial, it wasn't like this man says he can forgive sins, which you would have thought in terms of the ranking and blasphemous statements would have been higher than a man knocked down the temple. But it's the temple. So even just kind of realizing how significant that idea was, that paradigm shift was for Jesus, I just found really quite engaging. And so that, I think that kind of meant that I was able to kind of, and I, you know, I think I can do this most Easters and Christmases, kind of really bring my heart to it, you know, because there's something that I'm really interested
in. Well, it's the same old story. It's a fresh perspective, fresh vision, and that is energizing, you know?
So I found that really nice. So, you know, personally, a little bit quieter. From a preaching kind of theme perspective, I was quite engaged. So we'll call it a draw.
No, that's a win.
I think that's a win.
That's a win.
And knowing you, a quiet weekend, I'm sure you loved it.
I wasn't
complaining a lot.
I mean, I don't have to go out and see a whole bunch of people to celebrate a birthday. Oh,
well, that was my family. Be willing to spend time with my family.
It's just us. Okay, noted. Well, before I like dig any further into that emotional complex, let's get into the big three.
Okay, so the first question, Mark, is what barriers do we need to push through to establish a purple community?
Yeah. I think you guys made the point earlier that the Jews and Gentiles, particularly the Jews, had quite a few obstacles. You know, I didn't dig heaps into like temple architecture, but you know, there were some very deliberate and intentional signs if you were a Gentile about how far you could go into the temple and how and where you could no longer go.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when it talks about in Ephesians of Jesus tearing down the wall of hostility, you know, some commentators think that it might be referring to kind of those signs that say you can't go past this point or whatever the case might be. And a lot of those obstacles were, you know, like I don't want to just say cultural, but they were cultural and religious. You know, the food laws were fairly significant. The Sabbath regulations were fairly significant. Circumcision was significant, but I mean less so, in the sense that it wasn't. You know, it's a one-off thing that's done only to male babies in the Jewish culture. But there were still kind of obstacles if a Gentile God-fearer wanted to kind of take that final step and say, yes, I'm going to really associate myself with the people of God. So there's a whole bunch of those sorts of barriers. And I think we underestimate sometimes, which I don't know how we manage it, but I think we underestimate the impact of cultural differences.
Yeah.
You know, a really simple example. And you guys have heard me talk about church sizes before. Like I've talked about that a lot, kind of internally. And I remember reading very early in the piece that I will have more in common with someone from a different denomination who has a church of approximately the same size than I will of someone who shares all my theological concerns but has a church that's either much, much larger or much, much smaller.
Yeah.
Just on the basis that you're dealing with the same sorts of issues.
Yeah.
And my experience of that has been absolutely true, you know. And something as small as the size of a church, the number of people, the complexity of the organization can actually create a bit of a barrier.
Yeah,
between people. No, it's not. You can't. It's not like you can't overcome it. But that's enough to kind of go, oh man, I just see the world very, very differently.
We're on a different page. Yeah,
yeah. I have different issues, different problems, all those sorts of things. Let alone the complexity that we know exists in, say, racial or ethnic diversity. And those things, to some degree, can trip us up long before we get to the theology part.
Yeah.
You know, like long before we get to that, you know, just the things about, you know, the barriers that can be placed around language. You know, we're still fairly monocultural here, but in chatting to other pastors whose churches have gone through a period of increased multicultural growth and diversity, language becomes a really important question, you know, and even about not so much policy decisions, but about, you know, like, are we going to offer translation? Are we going to offer services in different languages? Or like all of those sorts of questions become really quite significant, and all of those can form barriers. So, I mean, I think to some degree, the question of what obstacles are there, like, there are heaps of them. And they are of varying degrees of severity, shall we say. But also I think, you know, and we've talked a bit about this, I think, on the podcast before, you know, speaking personally as a white middle-aged man, like I am the poster child of entitlement in lots of ways, right? And I think one of the things that I've become increasingly aware of over the last number of years, I suppose, is how unaware I am about the obstacles that other people face.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I think that not only are there lots of obstacles that can keep us from becoming unified and purple, but I think that there's also a whole bunch that we just don't see necessarily because we're so used to things. So, you know, I think about Gaimia as a community of faith. And I think one of the strengths of our community of faith is that we have a really high percentage of people who have been at the church for like 30 years or more. Like I've been on staff for 25 years and I am by no means the longest serving member of this church, like by a long way. You guys have been around enough to know that you know, you probably list off a dozen people without thinking about it who would have been here longer than that. And that has, you know, that means there's stability, And there's a strong sense of heritage. Like, there's a whole bunch of good stuff about that. But it can also provide, on the opposite, on the kind of on the flip side, a bit of an obstacle for new people making their way in who just haven't been around for 35 years.
Yeah.
And so don't know all the names that you refer to and don't remember that pastor and don't remember that ministry or whatever the case might be.
In jokes.
Yeah.
And the, you should have been there.
Yeah, we've always done it that way.
Yeah, or whatever the case might be. So you find that sometimes your strengths, the strength of a community, can also kind of have a shadow side.
Yeah.
That's unintentionally, that can unintentionally create obstacles.
Mm.
So I think that for any community of faith, we have to be we have to be aware of, I guess, where obstacles potentially lie, right?
Yeah.
You know, I think the other another potential obstacle that we can have from a long-serving community is that there's a certain degree of biblical knowledge, for instance, that we can kind of bring with us, because, you know, we've all been in the church for 35 years or 40 years, and so
you've all heard this story before.
Yeah, you may remember this psalm, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's right.
When we preached on it in 2006, you'll remember the series well. Yeah,
and then people are like, "No, I don't."
And I remember working with a young lady, and she had come from a non-faith home. Like, she kind of came to faith through friends in her late teens. And her reflection was that she always felt really awkward in those moments, because people would say, "Well, you all know the story." And she's like, I don't know the story.
Yeah.
You know, they're like the old familiar Sunday school story. And they're like, I didn't go to Sunday school, so I have no idea what you're talking about. And then just feeling like she should have known those stories and didn't, and feeling on the outside, and can you ask questions, and all of those sorts of things. Now, again, I think that there are probably more significant obstacles than those, but I think the kinds of obstacles that keep us from being united together are myriad.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's a reason why the Christian church has struggled to remain unified. You know, I think we bring a lot of that stuff with us. So, you know, I think that each community of faith needs to ask some of their own questions around that, and to try to develop enough diversity.
Yeah. You know?
I think we need to be very careful, and this is probably a little bit all over the place. I might need a break, but, you know, speaking of waffling, but, you know, I think that we probably need to be probably aware of kind of how, where we draw the line on inclusion, if that makes sense, right? Because we want to include as many people as we possibly can, but we don't want to lose our distinctiveness, right? That's part of the dilemma, right? You know, so for the people of, you know, for the Jewish people, I'm not going to say they were happy to, but like, if a Gentile God-fearer, like, they're always held in high respect, right? Like, the Jews would have been very happy with a Gentile who, you know, submitted to the law of Moses, even in part.
Yeah.
But there was something about their, this is what sets us apart, and these are the things you have to adhere to be part of us. And the thing about the challenge, I think, about the purple, right, is that we have been made one through the death and resurrection of Jesus. He's created this community, a new humanity out of the two. And then when he talks about the building of the temple and the dwelling of God, talks about the fact that it's built on the apostles and the prophets. So there's something about the Old Testament, the Hebrew scriptures, the prophecies, the story of Israel, the law of Moses, that still has bearing on this new purple community that also is shaped by God's plans to have included everybody from the very beginning, the image of God, the big picture stuff.
Yeah.
And so I think how we determine the boundaries becomes important, right? And I think that, you know, too often we focus on the boundaries rather than, I don't know, rather than the color. You know, like, it's, I think it's the, in social sciences, I believe it's the differences between a closed and an open set. Right? So a closed set has boundaries, and the whole idea is to get over the boundary. And once you're over the boundary,
you're in.
An open set just says, here's the center.
And get as close as
you can. We move to or from. And I think the church ought to be an open set.
Yeah.
But at some point, there are expectations, beliefs, behavior that, you know, that kind of guides a community of faith. So I think there's all sorts of challenges in that. I think that one of the other, like I think we see this very clearly, is as cultural norms shift, that has implications for obstacles in the church. And I think the tendency of the church has been to, and I talk about not Gaimia per se, but the church universal, has been to make cultural norms universal. Which we then get into trouble as soon as cultural norms change. Now, we can't just change what we believe or how we behave based on what our culture is doing. But like we do have to take into account that there's those sorts of changes as well. So like, and, you know, again, all over the shop really, but yeah, lots of obstacles, some that we see, some that we don't. Good luck with that.
Yeah. I think the thing that stood out to me in all of that, Mark, was like that for some of us, the obstacle might be to notice the obstacles in front of others. And I think there lies a really significant invitation, particularly for anyone who feels like they are in. I was reminded of there's a Uniting Church local to my home who have cracker signs that they just throw out. And the current one is around the current election, and it's, you know, who you vote for determines whose like issues are going to be dealt with. I've butchered the quote. I apologize. But you get the premise of there's an invitation to actually consider issues and barriers and challenges that someone else is facing and then advocating on their behalf. I think that there lies a powerful invitation as we kind of...
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, if you think about the context in Ephesians where Paul is obviously addressing an issue of some sort of division, you know, where was the onus of responsibility? Like if Paul had been pushed, if he'd done a big three podcast following
his message
the
on
publication
Sunday.
Of the letter, you know, we've just got a few questions about Ephesians, you know, like, just a few. And someone had said, you know, who has the, like, who needs to start? Who goes first? Like I suspect that Paul would have said the Jews. Like, because they were, shall we say, the insiders, right? Paul identifies them as those who were near to God, still in need of salvation, as he opens in chapter 2, still in need of forgiveness, still dead in their transgressions, but they were near. They had the covenants, they had the promises, they had the scriptures, they had the prophecies. And so they were probably the insiders. And so for them, it was probably their responsibility to make sure that the Gentiles who were joining them felt like they were near. You know, hey, Matt, do you know, I mean, he just, you know, Rox just referred to that old Sunday school story.
Do you know, what
do you know that Sunday school story?
Let me tell you.
You know, and I think to your point, Matt, I think those of us who feel like insiders do need to be looking for those who may be outsiders and not expecting them to just behave like an insider, but actually to say kind of what's keeping you from feeling comfortable here and how can I advocate on your behalf and those sorts of things.
And I guess like because we're not looking for blue with red dots or red with blue stripes or whatever it is, we're looking for something new. So also not only welcoming them in and making sure that they feel included, but allowing them to be a part of the reshaping of what community looks like. So like and working together as equals.
Early involvement.
To make that purple.
It's a positive use of power. I think the power sits in with the in community and for them to actually utilize their power to be more inclusive.
And to hand it over.
To hand it over.
Hand it over.
And there's such humility and you've got to let go of all the arrogance that we're the in, we're right, we're we're the kind of default.
But this gives me the influence and this gives me the authority.
And there's a self-protection to that when you hold on to that power. It's, you know, just sort of maintaining the status quo. And it won't happen by accident. You know, you've got to deliberately, you know, let that power go, include those people. And so it's not something that's going to happen just – it's just going to happen one day. It's actually intentional. And I think that's probably one of the barriers is you said seeing it, but then acting on it. You know, having that intentional vision. You know, who can I include? Who can I draw along? Who can I bring in? Who can I share my power with or give it over to?
Love that. Good stuff. Well, there you go. Let's move on to question two. So Mark, obviously, you know, Jesus' death and resurrection saw the creation of a new temple and a new community, this new purple way of being with God. And as we look around today, I guess if we can push the analogy even further, there is a lot of different shades of purple. Is it a problem that there seems to be different types of community? Or are we winning just because we're in the same wheelhouse? Is that a
color
spectrum?
On the color spectrum? Yeah, same wheelhouse.
Yeah, I'm not sure that that is works.
But no, there's a color wheel.
Thank you.
But a wheelhouse is different.
All right, guys. I tried to be smart. Like, thank you for just.
It is in the same. Well, part
I don't feel on the inside. Is what I'm saying.
Well, you shouldn't have asked. Does that make sense? Because then you invited.
I'll share my power with you.
Can we get back to the question now? Can we get back to the question?
We sure can. Listen, I think, you know, one of the things that I observed, I think, and one of the reasons why I chose, you know, to say that the Jews and Gentiles were, you know, blue and red instead of black and white is because black and white, when we kind of polarize issues, then ends up becoming a matter of purity and separation, right? And so anything that taints the white must be resisted and defended against.
Dilute.
Whereas I think once you realize that, no, you know, both colors, they're colors.
Yeah.
You know, there's, they're both valid and mixed together. They create something that's not impure red or impure blue, but purple, something new. And I reckon that in terms of the, you know, the denominational spectrum, I think as long as we can appreciate the purple, I think that it's fine. I think once the color scheme shifts to black and white and we're right and you're wrong, we're in, you're out, we're pure, you're not, we're orthodox, you're like, once it becomes a matter of separation and purity, I think that's when we run into some danger because then the other is resisted and is lumped in as, you know, kind of evil and, you know, like it's a hop, skip and a jump to see
pretty extreme.
Yeah.
Opinions.
You know? Like we're bound for heaven. Everyone else isn't. It's like, oh, okay. That black and white piece, I think is where we run into problems. And I think, you know, I think many people have been in situations where there's been that kind of black and white experience of, not necessarily denominations even, but different theological opinions or views. And there's a spectrum, of course, you know, and there'd be a whole bunch of stuff, religious beliefs and interpretations of scripture and whatnot that I would disagree with, that I would think are not particularly great readings of scripture or whatever the case might be. But I'm also willing to say that there are some that are probably valid, even though I don't agree with them, if that makes sense. And so I think we do need to be focused on the purple, right? I remember years and years ago, I think when I was still doing my undergraduate in Canada, I can't remember in what context or what class I was doing, but I ended up reading an article that was really influential for me on different types of spirituality. It talked about, you know, like an activist spirituality, you know, so think like the Salvation Army, right? Where, you know, Jesus is found and we experience God in caring for the poor and the marginalized. Like that's where God's found. And there's like a liturgical spirituality where God is found in the sacraments. Like that's where we experience God. You know, you think about like a high Anglican or perhaps an Orthodox, you know, kind of spirituality. There's an academic spirituality that they talked about, which I found really helpful studying and just kind of going, oh, yeah, God can be found in commentaries and theological thought.
I'm still good.
And the light came on.
That's right. Well, I remember reading I think it was an evangelical spirituality. It talked about, you know, God's encountered in the word and in prayer and in daily devotions, that kind of thing. And I remember reading the description of it and I thought, well, that's not spirituality. It's just kind of like how you do things, right?
Yeah.
And the little inner narrator in your head's kind of like, dude, that might be your spirituality. And I think that kind of moment of going, oh, I really identify with one in particular, but realizing that there was a breadth of them was really helpful for me to recognize that there are particular there are particular spiritualities that, you know, the church that I was a part of and the church that I'm leading now, we're not going to cater to particularly well.
Yeah.
And I think that while we want to be, you know, as inclusive of other forms of spirituality as we can be, we can't really deny who we are, you know? And so we want to serve the poor and we want to care for the marginalized and be engaged in that sort of work, but that's not our primary spirituality. So I think that there are, at that very basic level, there's need for different colors of purple, right?
Different
shades of purple to kind of go, like this denomination, or perhaps a tradition is probably a better way to talk about it. This tradition focuses on this kind of a spirituality and it'll speak to a certain group of people. Again, remember doing this is after that article, probably several years after it. I remember reading something around, it's like Myers-Briggs and spirituality types. And again, it was just a really helpful overlay. I'm not entirely convinced that, you know, if you've got a certain Myers-Briggs profile that you're kind of locked in, but it made sense that there were certain profiles that you kind of went, that would lend itself to that kind of a spirituality. And, you know, kind of seeing it even in my own profile of kind of going, that kind of works for me, you know? So, you know, just recognizing that to some degree, because spirituality is so broad, we kind of need more than one color. We can't have one size fits all. You know, I remember I think it was a C.S. Lewis quote where he just talks about, you know, I think it's in Mere Christianity when he says, you know, if we're all being made like Jesus, isn't that going to be a little bit dull? Like we're all going to look exactly the same. He's like, Jesus is so infinitely magnificent and multifaceted that even if every single one of us were perfectly conformed to an aspect of Jesus, we still wouldn't
look the same.
We still wouldn't look the same and we wouldn't fully reflect everything that he is. And I think, that's the God we serve. And therefore you would expect the God of the infinite, the multifaceted, the creative, the transcendent, unimaginably ineffable, like the whole, like why would there only be one type of church? You know, why would there be only one type of color? Like that would just be, it would almost be, could be a bit embarrassing to say, our God is incredibly creative, but there's just one type of us.
Which is our way.
And it's just standard purple. You know, forget that magenta, forget that lilac, forget that, you know, no.
In the shades of purple as well. Am I the only one who only sees purple as purple?
Well, my wife's an artist.
My brother is an artist.
That's all I got, really.
That's me too.
I don't think she's ever really talked about purple, but I'm just going to play that card. But, you know, so like I think to some degree, there should be. So I don't think there's a problem at all. But the problems come in when we stop thinking in colors and we get very black and white on stuff. And I think that's when things become problematic for us, where we say that a different spirituality is not just different, but it's
wrong
or lesser or whatever the case might be. And so those are tensions. I think that the church, again, universally, I'm not sure has always been particularly good at maintaining like the nuance between those.
I've hearing you speak about the breadth of spirituality and that all speak value and that all speak to different types of people who have different experiences and are on different journeys and have been called in different ways. And I just want everyone to listen to that answer and kind of go, okay, let's be purple. Like, let's stop talking black and white. Because I think, you know, before you said that, I was like, so the problem, I was thinking about the question. I was like, so the problem isn't the different types of purple. The problem is the perception that it should be black and white. And that's where, and I think that's when we get discomfort and uncertainty when we see people experiencing a different type of spirituality to the one that we've grown to know,
or that we're most comfortable with.
Comfort
factor.
Because so much of the discourse is that it's black or white, and I don't think we've utilized that conversation of this is a spectrum of color.
And I, you know, I mean, from a historical perspective, I think one of the one of the challenges to that is that a lot of, shall I say, a lot of the best theology is done in the fire of conflict and crisis. Right? You know, so very rarely in church history do you find that there's just this casual, friendly, informal conversation about a really important doctrine that they just kind of all meet collegially and collaborate together and, you know, come up with a creed and everyone goes, oh, that was great. We should do this again, you know.
That was a great brainstorming session, great, guys. Everyone. Well done,
love
everyone.
Love doing life with you.
Yeah. You know, like a lot of the best theology, I guess. Yeah. Has come out of the fires of crisis, you know, where you end up almost from the starting point seeing the other as the other. I am right, you are wrong, we are right, you are wrong, right? The us and them almost immediately. And so sometimes I think some of our denominations have been forged out of those sorts of crises. And therefore we've kind of almost set ourselves to say, you're not just different. You're not just a different shade of purple. You're not just another example of the kingdom of God and the temple of God. You are somehow wrong in a fundamental kind of way. Yeah. So I think that's worth kind of keeping in mind as well. It's not as if, you know, like it's not as if the church has done great theological work, again, kind of just on the quiet.
In a vacuum.
Yeah.
In the creeds are about those you exclude, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I've always found that a little bit fascinating, you know, that. You know, that's where theology tends to take those big steps forward, which makes sense because you need someone to push against something in order for you to kind of go, no, let me clarify that.
Yeah.
And so there's something really valuable about, you know, it's that iron sharpening iron piece, but it's iron sharpening iron. So it's, there's a lot of sparks.
Well,
there we go.
We'll look forward to that. Great. Let's move on to question three.
All right, Mark. So this is something you said in your sermon that you haven't said for a while. So old listeners, talking about the in crowd here, might find this familiar. You often say that anyone can begin to follow Jesus. And then you often say, but eventually you'll come to a sort of a crisis point and you'll have to make some decisions. But if anyone can begin to follow Jesus, what might that look like? And is it different to faith? You know, what does it look like if somebody is just starting to follow Jesus?
Well, I think that, you know, we would say that following Jesus is, you know, in terms of discipleship, it's about putting his teachings into practice. It's about trying to live in ways that conform with his plans and purposes. And so I think you'd begin by doing that, you know, so read the Gospels in particular, you know, the first four books of the New Testament that outline Jesus' teaching, and be asking yourself, you know, we talk about, you know, those four reading the Bible together questions. You know, one of them is like, what's the invitation for me? Like, if this is true, what does this mean for me? And then do it. And I think, again, we've sometimes said that you've got to believe before you can start, right? You know, kind of like, you know, you must be this tall to ride this ride. Until you're this tall, you can't get on the ride.
And
I think what we're basically saying with the journey of the journey to faith, or the journey of following Jesus, is you just start following him. And you kind of eventually, because, you know, I do believe eventually you come to the point where you're going to have to figure out who Jesus really is.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. But I think to some degree, it's as simple as that. You know, this is going back quite a ways, so there'll be fewer insiders, but the what would Jesus do bracelets, you know?
WWJD.
I was a fiend for the WWJD wristband.
It's still a good saying. I will stand by it. It's still
loved
it's
it.
But to some degree, that's where following Jesus begins. Like, what would Jesus do? And then I'm going to try that. Because what Jesus, again, I think this is where, you know, talking about what Jesus accomplished in his death and resurrection more broadly than one or two themes is actually quite helpful. You know, Jesus certainly came to forgive sins and he came to restore our relationship with God, but he's come to basically say, this is the best way to live, right? This is the best way to live now. Again, he's interested in our eternal destiny, but that's not his. Like, there's not a lot in scripture about our eternal destiny, apart from the fact that there is one, right? It's mostly about the here and now. But how do you live here now? How do you put this into practice now? And so, I think we need to be recognizing that Jesus has said, this is how you should live. This is the best way to live. Mm. You love your enemies.
Yeah.
Pray for those who persecute you. What? Right. Well, okay. Mm-hmm. You know, put that into practice. Mm. You know?
Like, yeah.
And I think the other thing that's really helpful in terms of the beginning of that journey is finding some traveling companions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Remember reading a book, but it was about a guy named called Christopher Booker. So he certainly should have written a book. And the book was on the seven basic plots. And he basically said that every story boils down to seven basic plots.
Very good.
And then he spoiled all sorts of stories. Oh. he warned you that he was going to do it, but it was kind of like,
I hate that guy.
But anyway, one of the plot forms is the quest. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, you leave on a journey, because you have to, and you do something, and when you return, things have changed. Mm. Right. Lord of the Rings. Yeah. And there are always companions along the road. And, I think that when we're talking about the journey of faith, it shouldn't be a solo effort. It should be something that we journey with somebody.
A fellowship.
Oh, yeah. Zing.
There you go.
Nailed it.
And so I think that you want to begin following Jesus with other people.
Yeah.
And it's probably worth having someone who's followed Jesus a little bit longer than you have. Mm. You know, whether they've been following Jesus for a long time or a short time, someone that you can ask your questions of, for instance, someone who you can say, you know, I don't know that Sunday school story.
Yeah, exactly. But also Jesus says some really tricky things, right? You know, if your eye offends you, you know, pluck it out and send it away. Cast it away.
I mean, I think love your enemies is probably tricky enough, but yes.
But you know what I mean.
Some of his imagery is quite tricky too.
Exactly. So, you know, you want someone who's been around the traps to go, actually, you know what? Probably not physically, but let's look at that as a metaphor.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. And I think that there's great value in then having someone else that you're kind of traveling with. And you know, in terms of a traveling companion, I think you want someone who's going to allow you to begin to follow Jesus and make those voluntary decisions about when you're going to follow Jesus and, you know, and kind of let you kind of go at your own pace in that sense, which can be tricky. To find, because I think, you know, I think for those of us who have come to the point of placing our faith in who Jesus claims to be, our desire is that anyone who begins to follow Jesus would come to the same realization that we do. And so it's very easy for me to become a little bit impatient to kind of go, don't you see it yet? Yeah. Don't you see it yet?
Jesus is awesome. Let's go.
and forget that really it's the work of God in someone's life. Mm. I think that, you know, I think the other thing to begin is to pray, you know, talk to God.
Yeah.
There's no kind of formal, I mean, there are formal sets of words, but you don't need to use formal sets of words. Mm. I think journaling, you know, journaling has always held for me this wonderful ideal, but whenever I try to do it, it lasts for 2 days.
You start a new book every time. Pretty much. So you just got a whole bunch of notebooks with three pages written.
Or I've got a book that I've been using for like 45 years it's still got like seven entries in it or something.
It's not
every 3 years, there's like something. Yeah, it's not my spirituality, you know, some sort of a keeping track of, you know, today I tried this. Mm-hmm. You know, and this is the experience.
Epic fail.
Yeah, or whatever.
And that's
Yeah, or, you know, I want to pray for my boss because I think he's a jerk, but Jesus says I should. So
here we go.
What does that mean? And then, all those sorts of things. So I think in the context, that idea for me of anyone can begin to follow Jesus came out of Matthew 4, where Jesus calls his disciples. And you know, for those of you who've listened to the sermon or heard me talk about this before, Jesus doesn't ask whether they know much about him, doesn't demand that they change their life, and doesn't demand that they believe in him. And as the book, as the story unfolds, it becomes clear that they have no idea who he is. So it's a good thing he didn't ask that as a starting point. But I think that it would then be useful to begin to learn more about Jesus, right? To read more, to ask more questions, to attend a community of faith, a church someplace where you can actually hear more about Jesus, where you can explore the potential implications of following Jesus in terms of your lifestyle choices. Like be forewarned, you know, following Jesus, if you end up placing your faith in him, there'll be some consequences about how you
mm-hmm.
choose to live your life. And so you don't want to kind of wait until you go, yep, I believe in Jesus. Now what's next? I have to what? Mm-hmm. You know, I can't do this. What? So I think you want to explore those sorts of things because, you know, Jesus himself says, you know, count the cost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, you can take up your cross and follow me, another tough statement.
Yeah.
What does that look like?
Mm.
And then I think you want to be exploring the questions of faith.
Yeah.
You know, you might start following Jesus as a great moral teacher, but Jesus says a bunch of stuff about himself that kind of makes that hard to hold. So asking yourself, okay, well, what do I believe about Jesus? And kind of coming back to that question relatively frequently, you know, maybe even coming back to Jesus's question to his disciples of like, who do you say that I am?
Mm.
You know, just, and maybe set that as kind of your, a kind of a regular reflection question.
Nice.
You know? And if you're someone who's traveling with someone who is exploring faith, that's probably a good question to ask.
Yeah.
Like, who do you say Jesus is?
Mm.
You know, and it's okay for people to say,
yeah. I don't know,
a great teacher.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, a historical figure who had some interesting ideas about God. Oh, okay, great.
Yeah.
You know, but I think that's where you want to keep coming back to. You know, again, to quote C.S. Lewis, the English writer of the 1900s, you know, he describes his conversion as, you know, I can't remember where they were going, but when he got in the car, he wasn't a Christian. And when he got there, he was and it was something had changed for him. And there was no kind of lightning bolt. There was no word from above. It was just, oh, I do believe this, you know?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think coming back to that question of who do I say Jesus is? Who is he to me now?
Mm.
I think is a really worthwhile evaluatory question to be asking. So I think it's as simple and as complex as that.
Wow. This is fantastic.
No, but I think that's like, cause really whether you are just seeking to follow Jesus or even if you have made a decision of faith, you've gotten to that crisis point and you've stepped over the threshold, so to speak. Like these are like, this is all just what living in a relationship with Jesus requires us to consider. So it doesn't matter where you are on that journey. If it's an open sect, it doesn't matter how close you are to the center.
Yeah.
These are all the kinds of questions that we need to be asking ourselves. Yep. Otherwise, you can find yourself no longer following Jesus, like just kind of got lost along the way and found yourself somewhere else.
Yep.
Or you could find your faith kind of dry up a little bit because you've not really tended to it. So
I ticked the boxes once and now I'm over that border and I'm good to go.
Yeah, but that's not it.
But I think we have to keep asking those questions, you know, about what do I know about Jesus? What do I believe about Jesus?
So good.
What are the implications of that for my life and taking that quite seriously.
Awesome. Well, way Mark, thanks so much. Another big three, the final big three for you.
Yes.
For a hot little minute.
For a hot little minute, I'll be back in July, I guess.
I'm sure you'll return with notes and suggestions. And
maybe some more journal pages.
Yeah, some more journal pages maybe. We'll see.
Yeah. I'll have journaled once.
Yeah. So, but you'll get a new book for it.
Well, and I mentioned this to a few people about, you know, what am I going to be doing, and spoke to my mentor about his long service leave. And he said something kind of curious, but which made a lot of sense, which was whatever he did, he didn't want to fail long service leave. So in other words, you know, instead of saying
keep the bar low.
To some degree,
Like,
it was fine to say that you're going to read, he said, but don't say you're going to read five books because then you could fail and not read those
then
five books.
Bad.
So I'm not going to journal because I don't want to fail long service leave unless I say I'll journal once. Even then, I don't know.
Yeah, it might still be a bit too hard to say.
Maybe journaling?
No, it's hockey.
Stick with what you know.
I think I can also commit to that.
Well, good luck. We hope you win.
Yes.
long service leave and hockey.
Thank you very much. I saw what you did there.
Yeah. Nailed it. Oh, Rox, that was huge. That was a doozy.
Wasn't it massive?
I dug it. There was so much in there. What was the one thing? If you had to pick, and you do because I'm asking you to.
All right.
If you had to pick one thing.
Oh, I think for me, just the helpful that there's, it's okay to have different types of purple. I think that's super helpful for us as a church and as a community. And I know Mark's about to go on long service leave and he's probably going to walk into a bunch of different churches over that time. And sometimes when I've walked into different churches, they kind of do things a bit different. You know, they maybe worship in a different way or they have a different language around the way they see God. And sometimes it sort of jolts me a little bit out of my everyday. And I think that's actually really healthy for me because then I can go, you know what, God is so much bigger than my little patch of purple, right? God is so much bigger than my experience, my expression of churchmanship, you know, the way I worship, the way I pray, the way I relate to the Lord. So just seeing that broad perspective and that God is so much bigger than that. And I've got to like let go of my judgment on the way I perceive other people and to go, you know what? You know, Jesus is the center. Jesus is the one we're worshiping and he is building his church and it's going to look different for a bunch of different people. And you know what? That's okay with God. So therefore, that's got to be okay with me.
Yeah. Awesome. So I love that. Stuff. Right on.
What about yourself?
Oh, I think that like still from question one, I'm still kind of mulling over the whole, like particularly if you're someone who feels like they're purple already, who feels like I kind of, I know where I am, I know what I'm doing and I know my place here, that there's a responsibility to then advocate and create space for others to experience the community and the church and the temple that, you know, we have had the privilege of experiencing only through the grace of God and through the sacrifice of Jesus. So I'm just, you know, I'm aware that if we're using this insider outsider language, which comes up a lot, particularly around Jews and Gentiles, you know, I would say that I'm an insider. I mean, it's hard to be a pastor of a church and not be an insider, I guess. Yeah. So then, the work that I need to do is not about getting in. It's not about being purple. It's about helping others become purple or experiencing that purple.
Yes.
To push the analogy to the absolute breaking point. I think that responsibility is really, it's important. It's an important one. So,
To be maybe more intentional in that
absolutely,
space.
Absolutely.
No, it's really good.
So, yeah. Anyway, another cracker, Big Three. Thank you so much.
Great
and
to be here.
We'll see you next time.
Awesome.
Well, if you want to be a part of the conversation, make sure that you're there at one of our services this Sunday and that you snap the Slido QR code or follow the link before the sermon to get involved. If you've enjoyed the Big Three podcast today, take the time to give a star rating and be sure to subscribe to stay up to date with all future episodes. Speaking of new episodes, next week we will be releasing a fourth question, looking at the topic of deconstructing faith. Should we do it? Why would we do it? How do we do it? Well, thanks for joining us for this week's Big Three and our deep dive into God's invitation for us all. Remember, there's no thought too small, no question too big.